Welcome to Australia's Fiercely Independent Property Podcast.
Residential property is the only asset class we live in. It is where we raise our families, and it's our most expensive investment, yet property advice remains unregulated.
Listen to three pioneers of the property industry, each with diverse areas of expertise in property planning, buying, and education.
We'll distill the raw truth from the ill-informed.
Join the property planner, David Johnston, the property buyer, Kate Bakos.
That's me.
And the property professor, Peter Kalizos, as we take you on a journey through the maze of property, mortgage and money decisions to empower you to create your ideal lifestyle.
Hello and welcome everyone to the Property Planner, Buyer and Professor podcast. It's great to have your company again. And geez, what a week it's been. We've certainly got an action-packed episode today. It's a market update and we had a huge announcement yesterday, but before we get stuck into that, let's have a quick chat to Dave and Kate. Kate, how are you?
I'm really well, although I was a bit bummed that we all got it wrong for yesterday's announcement. And, you know, it just goes to show that these things aren't always easy to predict. And I've had an interesting week, Pete, and I had one auction on Saturday and we were expecting competition. I did my call out to the agent and asked all about how many are going to be putting their hands up, how many building inspections have you had, how many contracts have gone out, you know, the burning questions that give you a good idea about how many will likely be competing for it. And I was reassured that, you know, it was going to be a tight competition and we had interested parties and people had tried to make offers prior. So I was ready for battle. I threw out my opening bid and it was crickets. And the agents were working the crowd.
Typically, that's what you get, isn't it?
Yeah.
At an auction when you're waiting.
Absolutely. And I was in Doncaster, which is a tough market sometimes to understand how the bidding's likely to go because you're dealing with multiple cultures who don't always show their cards in a way that you expect. And so the agents are working the crowd. They're huddling around groups. I can see the heads nodding the right way. People are saying, no, I'm not bidding. And I could quickly tell that the competition I thought I had, it wasn't there. So it passed in and I had to be able to jump straight into pass-in battle, which is a very different type of battle. You've then got to be armed with your comparable sales and ready to fight it out, and you've got to balance that precarious situation where you don't offend the vendor enough or annoy the agents or give them an idea that you're not near enough to being able to purchase a property for the right price because they can send you outside, close the door, and all of a sudden your exclusive opportunity to negotiate's gone and it hits the internet and then you might have competition. And the interesting thing about some markets is buyers who don't like auction might be prepared to fight harder when they can see a private sale advertised price. So you have to remember that when you're at auction, do you let it go and then fight the others for it or do you stay inside and try and come to some kind of agreement? So it was an interesting one.
You reckon that's a reflection of the market, Kate, a slowing market, in particular auctions in Melbourne?
Not necessarily, but it was certainly a reflection of the area. You know, some areas and some cultures and demographics are harder to read and harder to get bidding. And I think an agent always has to understand not only the timing of the market and where they are in the market cycle, but also how likely the contingent of buyers is going to be to put up the hand and bid.
Right. Okay. Thanks for that. Dave, how are you going?
Yeah, I'm good, Pete. I mentioned last week that most of the family had been hit with the flu and we'd come out the other side, but poor old Annabelle's had the flu now since Saturday. So I've been being kicked out of bed in the middle of the night.
But you're immune. And that's really good.
Yeah, I've managed. I think I had something a few weeks ago, so maybe it just wasn't as bad as.
Did you get your flu shot?
Yeah, I got the flu shot actually last Monday with Annabelle at her childcare, but it seems as though she's still got some version of the flu. So whether it's A or B or whatever it is, so, you know, that's, yeah.
Yeah, they are saying it's going to be a bad flu season this year because we've had it pretty easy the last 2 years, so. I went and got my flu shot. So if I do get it, hopefully it won't be too won't impact too bad.
We love hearing from our listeners and we'd love to tackle more of your questions. So please, if you have any on your mind, no matter how great or small, send us a message. You can email us info@propertyplannerbuyerandprofessor.com. or go to our website, Facebook page, or simply click on the link in your podcast app under the play button and fill out our online form.
So where do you want to start, team? Are we going to start with the big news or are we going to work up to the big news? What do you want to do?
Oh, let's get the big news out of the way. It's not the best.
Let's get the big news
out. Jump into it.
All right, Dave, you're our finance man on the show. Why don't you start us off?
Yeah, so look, we did our predictions last week, didn't we?
And yeah, got them wrong.
Got them wrong. Well, we said 25 basis points each, possibility of 40, and they've gone 50. So in hindsight, which was just, you know, it was about 12 hours ago from when we're recording this, but I can see the logic. I actually admire the fact they're trying to get on the front foot and being decisive rather than sort of slowly falling in behind rising inflation. Out of most Western nations, our inflation hasn't gone as far as the other countries. So, you know, they've obviously decided to get on the front foot. Now, reading a lot of the commentary, there's expectation of another 50 basis points next week. So
next month, you mean?
Sorry. Yeah, next month.
Okay, calm down, listeners.
Yeah, they're not having weekly meetings. One of my favourite economic journalists put out an article last night. Makes a lot of sense that the thing that embeds inflation and makes it really hard to bring it back is what's called a wage price spiral. You know, we're obviously hoping that inflation is temporary. You know, it's back to the 2 to 3% band within sort of, you know, 6 or 9 months. But if everyone starts raising their wages by where inflation sits at the moment at 5%, it embeds inflation. And the problem with that is then it becomes unsustainable and you start to see huge job losses generally once inflation lasts for an extended period of time. And obviously large job losses is much worse than slightly lower wage rises of say 2 to 3% and allowing us to bring back inflation back into that 2 to 3% band. But, you know, it's a tricky path to navigate, and it's good to see a Reserve Bank who's willing to be decisive, I think. I can see the logic behind the 0.5 decision.
I mean, I'm not a macroeconomist, but if most of us are on enterprise bargaining agreements, how are wages going to increase quickly? Like at uni, I don't know when our agreement was agreed to, but we've already factored in, it's on paper in black and white, like wages are going to increase 1% or 2% a year for the next few years. We can't do anything about that. Now, I know everyone's not on an EBA or enterprise bargaining agreement,
yeah,
but when the vast majority of the population are, I can't see wages increasing significantly across the board.
I think the unions will get to work, Pete, as the cost of living increases and people mm-hmm. can absolutely see the rate of inflation. I think back to when I was on enterprise bargaining agreements, you know, in my uni days, and we had a specific rate of pay increase. And again, when I was in corporate, which clearly wasn't governed by unions, again, they would respond broadly in line with the rate of inflationary pressure. And I remember in my corporate days when you'd have your performance assessment and you know, between 1 and 5 and everyone would get a 3 saying you've met objectives and you'd get the standard, whatever it was, you know, 4, 5. I remember one year it was 8% increase. So I think we will see the unions and certainly the big employers following that, because there'll be a lot of pressure on them to retain staff if they're not.
Yeah, and I think there's not as high a percentage on EBAs as there once was, Pete. So I think mm-hmm. the percentage of people on EBAs is much lower, and if it was as high as it used to be, then what you've said would be more correct. But with the push for the minimum wage workers, that's 180,000 workers. But generally what happens is if the minimum wage goes up, everyone on an award wage goes up by the same percentage.
Right.
And that's another 2.6 million workers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I think, you know, the concern is if the minimum wage goes up and then everyone on award wage goes up by that 5%, that goes from 180,000 to almost 2.8 million workers. going up. And then because not as many people are on EBAs as they used to be, so there's still most of the rest of the workforce are on, you know, just their own contracts, then they all start going, having wage increases, and companies and some government organisations can increase wholesale, the unions push harder, then it becomes, yeah, the wage price spiral.
Yeah, well, certainly an interesting space. We haven't had this sort of economic environment for decades. You know, back in the 70s and 80s, we had increasing inflation, increasing wages, but really for the last 20 or 30 years, it's been pretty much under control.
Yeah, it's uncharted for a lot. I was chatting to someone yesterday who, and a young person, they genuinely asked me, Kate, should we be buying a property now or should we wait 6 months? And I said, okay, so talk me through what you think the advantage is in waiting 6 months. And they said, well, you know, if the increasing interest rates topple house prices, we could, you know, buy something for less money or we could get more value. And I said, look, it's a really tough one for me to answer because I've come from a background where when I was actively buying property, we were pretty used to moving interest rates, and part of that movement was upward movement. And we've got a contingent who for 11 years have never experienced an increased interest rate. So for some of us, it's like, yeah, okay, we're having to deal with increased cost of holding property. But for others, it's totally uncharted, and it would feel like such a shock to a lot of people. And the question I ask myself is, will all of these, you know, millennials and Gen Ys who haven't experienced increasing interest rates react differently to what we would have reacted under the same circumstances at the same age? Because if they all react differently, that could have an impact on supply and demand.
Yeah, well, their perception is it's not over a long period of time, but for like you, Kate, when we were buying property, generally, interest rates were increasing during that time. It's only really since 2000s that we've had 2010 that interest rates have continuously dropped. For me and probably people of my era, you know, it doesn't alarm us as much because we've been through this before. We might cut back spending in other places, like we may not go out as much or hang on before we buy a new car or go on an expensive holiday. But the last thing we're going to do is stop paying our mortgage. Unlike the 70s and the 80s, where we had, and the 90s in particular, where we had really high unemployment, generally speaking, anyone that wants a job has got it. And if you don't like your job, you can probably find a different one next week. So that's the saving grace. That's a very big safety net for us, I think. The fact that, all right, inflation is increasing, interest rates are increasing, but thankfully, unemployment is very low.
And to your point, Pete, for investors who are worried about feeling the pinch, our vacancy rates are very, very low as well, which is another safety net.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that later on in this show, you know, almost at historical lows. And let's not forget the interest rate rises that you've had, not the interest rate rises, the rental rises you've had over the last year. Investors are probably sitting better than owner-occupiers because owner-occupiers don't have that increasing rent to offset the increasing mortgage repayment.
Kate and I have been buying property for about 25 years or so. We've had
rates. You're only young bucks, you two.
So
Dave's the baby. I'll just put it out there.
Yeah, I remember rates going up, rates going down, and it was just part of what happened.
Yeah.
But I think now, a decade on, people are a bit more shocked with rates going up. And maybe it's also the fact, you know, we're in this really strange time. We've just lived through COVID. We're still coming out the other side of that. People are a bit more probably pensive around what might occur. You know, we've had things like Russia invade Ukraine and other happenings around the world and within Australia that have perhaps have caused people to be a bit more concerned about what might come that they haven't foreshadowed. But if we just look at the perspective picture, rates prior to COVID, the Reserve Bank rate was 1.5%. And if people may have forgotten, Melbourne and Sydney were on a tear with property price rises, you know, so they'd already risen by a bit over 10%. We're only now at 0.85. Okay, so I'll just say that again. We're at 1.5% prior to COVID, and Melbourne and Sydney property prices were flying off the back of a flat period, off the back of the Royal Banking Commission. What's the actual way you say that again?
Royal Commission.
Into Banking Royal Commission.
Yeah. Off the back of the Banking Royal Commission.
Off the back of that commission we had.
It's been up since three. Give him a break.
Oh, yeah. And embedded four. Anyway, so, you know, we're only at 0.85%. We're still at the lowest cash rate it's ever been. We've still got 65 basis points to go for it to just get back to where it was prior to COVID.
Yeah. I think that's a great point, Dave. I remember the crazy run we had in 2009. Like, our asset values just went stupid, and counting all this equity every month, it was changing, because that was a really big run following all of the government incentives and the things that they had to do following the GFC. And we were so excited about super low interest rates. They were record low back then. And I remember saying, oh, my gosh, we could get a variable rate for 5%. Let's buy more. Like, 5%. People are worrying about 5%. But 15 years ago, we thought that was an amazing rate.
Absolutely. I still remember when it was Bank of Melbourne and Westpac reduced their three-year fixed rate to 4.99%.
Yeah, groundbreaking stuff.
And we were like, wow, there's an interest rate with a four. Let's get on the phones and call all our clients. Yeah, so times have changed. But if we look at the history, and we're going to do a whole episode on it next week, generally, without giving away too much, generally speaking, rates, when they've risen, have risen between about 1% and 2%. You know, so we've just gone up by 75 basis points. But we're still 65 basis points below where it was at prior to COVID, which was the lowest on record. And you've got to think about how far might this run go. I know there's a lot predicting that it could get as high as 2.5 or even 3.5. I find it hard to imagine it going above even 2%.
Now, what you're talking about, just for clarity, is the equilibrium of the cash rate. So whatever
cash rate.
That's right. Yeah. So banks will pop their margin on there so they can stay in business, but nobody knows what that equilibrium will be until we get to it. And sometimes you slightly overshoot it, sometimes they completely overshoot it. But what you're referring to, and it's good for our listeners to understand, is when the inflationary pressure starts to ease and when things feel like they're in balance again.
Yeah, exactly. And so we're at 0.85, as I kept saying. We were at 1.5, the RBA cash rate, prior to COVID. Some are talking might get 2.5 or even 3.5. You know, let's say there's another 1%. I can't see us going much more beyond 1% beyond this year at least, so getting it up to around 1.85, 2%. And that's why I actually don't mind that they've gone harder earlier, because it allows them potentially to, and maybe it won't be next month, but to have a month off and just see the lay of the land and let some data come out to see the kind of impact it's having.
I said before, for those people that are worried, that one saving grace was low unemployment. The other one is the banks have already factored in that you can afford the mortgage if interest rates go up an extra, is it 3%, Dave? Is that the benchmark?
Yeah, that's 3%. Right. It was 2.5, yeah.
Right. Okay. January 3. So, yes, we need to be aware of what's happening, but we don't need to be alarmed, certainly not yet, because there's still plenty of fat in it so far as the bank is concerned. For investors, rents have gone up. But, yeah, you might want to keep an eye on. Generally, this is going to have an impact on your saving and on your spending. All right, might only be a couple, you know, a few hundred dollars a month or a couple of hundred dollars a month for most people, but that's still going to have an impact for some families. So you need to keep an eye on that. The three of us combined have been buying property for, cripes, maybe almost 100 years. No, I'm not that old. But we've been buying it for a long time, and we've been paying mortgages when interest rates were double digit, 13%, 15% and so on. Mm. We've been paying mortgages when unemployment was double digit. So for those that have been in the game only for a short period of time, I know it's a little bit worrying. But for those of us that have been around for a while, this is really just getting back to normal.
Yeah.
And we're not going to stay at a cash rate of 0.1 for very long.
Yeah.
And we were never meant to.
No, that's right.
That's right.
The only reason we were there is because of COVID. If COVID wasn't here, we would never have got down to that far.
We're still 65 basis points lower than we were prior to COVID.
Yeah.
And Pete, you made a really good point about the buffer rate. And just to clarify that, what it means is that over the last just over a decade, so for the last 11 years, the lowest servicing rate that anyone's borrowing capacity has been calculated on, the lowest rate is 5.5%. Currently, the banks are saying if rates went to 6%, you're good for it. We've analysed and evaluated your spending habits and your income and all of your expenses, and you could sustain a 6%. Actually, it's now sitting at, 6.25, Dave. So the banks are saying to anyone who's borrowed in the last month, that's what you're good for. But over the last 11 years, the lowest servicing rate that anyone's had applied to them is 5.5%. Correct me if I'm wrong, Dave.
That's right. People are significantly ahead on their mortgage repayments on average, and it's by a record amount. I feel like it's around 21, 22 months ahead is the average. And even if rates, I'm pretty sure reading last night that if rates go up by another percent, that'd only reduce by 2 months the average period of time most people are ahead on their repayments. You know, so we've actually got record levels of savings. And that's one of the other reasons they're actually gone harder, because they're worried that people will keep spending, which will keep driving up inflation because our record level of savings. So they're actually possibly wanting to go a bit harder on the rate rises so people keep a little bit drier and keep those savings rather than spend them and drive up inflation. So we're in a really strong position, and that's why rates go up too, which we should remember. If you look at some of the RBA's comments last night, like on the Australian economy is resilient, growing by 0.8% in the March quarter, 3.3% over the year. Household and business balance sheets are generally in good shape. An upswing in business investment is underway. That's what they've been really trying to get happen for a number of years. Business investment has been low, and there's a large pipeline of construction work to be completed. Macroeconomic policy settings are supportive of growth, and national income is being boosted by higher commodity prices. The terms of trade are at a record high because our commodities and natural resources are at record prices. Employment, as we, 3.9%, the lowest rate in 50 years. Job vacancies and job ads are at, super high levels. So this is why rates are going up. It's because the economy is so strong. If you just read that and just kept saying those things over and over on the news and in the media, everyone would be walking around with massive smiles.
They would be. Yeah. No, very interesting. The other promising thing is China has finally opened up after aiming for zero COVID. Mm. And one of the reasons inflation is going up is because of the supply constraint. It's not because there's a huge amount of demand, but you try and buy a car or buy a bike or even buy a fridge. You know, a lot of these things are made overseas, in particular in China. And if they were shut down so their factory workers couldn't go to the factory, well, they couldn't make anything. That'll ease up over time. Please don't worry. Look, take it from us. We've been around for a while. We've seen this before. We've come out of it. And for some people who have only bought recently, you've only experienced the really, really good times, like interest rates at historical lows, rents going up significantly, property prices going up significantly. That is not the norm. That is not the norm. So talking about prices, CoreLogic data came out recently. We've got a list of capital cities and what they've done over the month and the quarter and the year. Kate, did you want to start us on that?
Yeah, they've done absolutely nothing. This is a fascinating chart. We are so static, it's not funny. So the two big heavy hitters, Sydney and Melbourne, we've come off a little bit. And look, 1%, minus 1% for Sydney, I don't want to gloss over that. It's significant when you get a 1% movement in 1 month. But what I want to contrast this with is what's happened this month. We've had the federal election, we've had a rate increase, now we've had a second one. I would have expected to see more movement here. Now, the only capitals that have come off, Canberra's 0.1, so that's pretty negligible. Melbourne's 0.7, Sydney's 1%. Everything else is still exhibiting growth. And dare I say it, Pete, what on earth is going on in Adelaide? 1.8% in 1 month is still a runaway market. I just think that's incredible. And our regions, they've come off. Combined regional is now just 0.5%, but that's still, you use the word resilient, Dave. I would strongly say that right now, looking at the May snapshot, we've got a static market that's showing enormous resilience in spite of the shocks that we've been experiencing.
Adelaide is certainly one of the leaders, as is Brisbane. I checked some other data, and year to date, Adelaide's already done 10%. So from the 1st of January to the end of May, property prices have already increased 10%. Brisbane increased by 9.7%. If we just stick to Adelaide, even though it's done 10% in the first 5 months, I don't think it'll do 10% in the next 7 months. Things will start slowing. But when you look at it overall, especially over the year, property prices are higher today than they were a year ago in every capital city and in the regions. That's one positive. Yes, our two bigger cities are dropping in value, but we're talking single digits here, you know, 1%, 2%, when they've grown significantly over the last 18 months. And those regions, Kate, geez, they're going nuts, aren't they?
Yeah, look, the regions have been quite resilient, and I think stock levels, we always need to remember what drives these numbers. Supply and demand's the ratio. And when you've got more supply and same demand, you'll start to see the prices dropping. The regions have been very tight with supply, and there's no doubt about it. So even though demand has really slowed down, particularly I look at my own backyard, I'm not getting the same number of inquiries and same crazy quest for moving out of the city as I was a year ago. And we've got a lot of relocating people, numbers have dropped off, but we've still got locals in the regions that are keen to buy. And I think it's an incredible snapshot to see that the regions are still exhibiting positive growth, even though it's very, very slight.
Yeah, so combined capital's 11%, combined regional is double that, 22%. That's over the 12 months. Yeah. Phenomenal.
Yeah,
phenomenal.
So, I mean, if you look at the regions on a five-year average, their level of stock is 40% lower than the average of the last 5 years, but the number of sales is 20% higher than the average. So, you know, you've got push and pull in both directions that is positive for price values going up. The Aussie property market values have been decelerating for 12 months, and we've been talking about it in pretty much every market update. We've had, as we covered in one of the episodes in the last couple of weeks, this has been the third largest run on record. And one of the other two highest runs was 1951. Prices went up 100%
or 101% or 111%,
something stupid. So, you know, we put it in perspective. All good things must come to an end. And the most likely outcome here is we're about to enter the best 6 to 18 months of buying opportunity that there will be. And always whenever we have a flatter or attracting market, it always has been the best time to buy ever moving forward because then prices rebound again after what has generally been a 6 to 18 month period of flat or retracting prices. So that's worth everybody keeping in mind as well.
Interesting, Dave. And I reflect on investors out there who might be feeling a tad uncomfortable about rising interest rates. They're not rising at the same rate as rents, which probably leads us to the next point.
Yeah, it does. And excellent segue, Kate.
Yeah, and what that means for a lot of investors, particularly those that have held property for, you know, longer than 5 years, is across portfolios, we're now seeing a lot of people clicking over to cash flow neutral and then bumping into positive cash flow.
Yep.
Nice problem to have when you're getting taxed on your returns and you're losing your negative gearing benefit. It's an awesome problem to have.
Yep.
And this is exacerbating it because we're still in very, very low, record low interest rate environment, and we've got rents that are rising beyond where any of us thought they would, and it's not a pleasant time for renters. But certainly from a cash flow point of view, we're seeing a lot of people switch to positive cash flow, and that enables you to pay down your loan even quicker. If you're channeling that money straight into your offset account, you'll be sitting in a more attractive position.
And let's not forget, you know, if you want certainty, you can have certainty. You can fix your loans. You know, I describe it as like paying an insurance premium. You should go into it expecting to lose. Most people will have some variable so they can offset and some fixed. I say to my clients, you know, you should be barracking to lose on your fixed rate. Because if you end up winning, it means you're just paying more on your variable rate loans as well. So if you end up losing, well, at least your variable rate loans haven't got any higher because rates haven't been going up. So you can buy certainty on your investment debt, and you can buy certainty up to 5 years if you really want to. You know, we have got choices. We have got the ability to hedge and, you know, get long-term clarity. And so that might mean locking in all of the debt on one investment property or multiple investment properties. We should keep that in mind too with whenever we're in a cycle of tightening and rates going up. Just a quick reminder, you can access our show notes, including links to all of the resources we talk about on our website, which is propertyplannerbuyerandprofessor.com.au.
As you were saying, Kate, rates have gone up significantly. I know many investors who looking for new tenants, many tenants are just offering more than the asking price. So
it's not brutal.
Not very often that happens, but it certainly has been happening. Basically, for a few months after COVID hit, rents have been going up, and in particular last year, 2021, rents went up significantly. Anything else you two wanted to say on rents?
Yeah, I know we're running short for time because we've talked so much about yesterday's rate movement, but the charts, which will be in our show notes, Brisbane's house price rental growth is just insane, and it's still on the rise. And in fact, everything is on the rise. But to contemplate near to a 13% annualised rent increase is tough for so many families. And when we look at units, Melbourne now leads the charge on the rate of increase. And, you know, Melbourne's sitting at 9.8, which is so close to 10%. It means in 1 year, we've added, you know, 1/10 to our asking prices across the board. That's a generalised figure. So if we're segmenting it, I know that the CBD has really been playing catch up, and our vacancy rates are tightening, and we haven't even been smashed with new arrivals yet.
100%. And this is one of the things that we've talked about previously is going to put a floor under prices, is the rising rents, and yields are growing even faster because we're in this unusual period where prices are flattening and rents are rising, and rents are rising much faster than value increases. So yields are getting higher and higher. And so that's going to be enticing to investors. And there's this human condition when change, major change occurs, it only takes us a short period of time and we get used to it. And I think that'll end up happening with rates going up. It's the early stages of us getting used to rate rises for the first time in a decade. In the coming months, people will be used to it. Okay, yeah, well, rates are just occasionally going up. People will start getting their confidence back. And I think that's when we'll start to see more money coming back into the property market, and we'll be moving towards the end of this period of being a great time to buy. And rising rents and increasing yields are going to be one of the key factors that'll bring people back to the market.
In relation to vacancy rates, every capital city is under that magic number of 2%. 2% is seen as equilibrium. So I get, just to explain the vacancy rate, so if we had a vacancy rate of 2%, that would mean at this particular point in time, 2% of rental properties are vacant, which is deemed to be equal demand and supply at equilibrium. But every capital city is below that 2%. Adelaide at 0.4, Brisbane at 0.7, Canberra at 0.7. So, yeah, and as Kate mentioned, with overseas migrants continuing to come in and new supply of property not coming on very quickly because builders can't get the supply, the material, it's just going to continue to increase, unfortunately, for tenants.
Many of them are afraid to take on new projects and major projects.
Yeah.
You know, we've seen what's happened to some of the major building companies recently, and, you know, they lock into fixed price contracts and then lose all their margin with the rising costs. So, yeah.
Not pretty. Let's go back to what one of the things that affects property prices, and that is the supply of property for sale. And still, we are well below the five-year average. Hence, one of the reasons why in most capital cities, property prices are still going up despite other things that might be trying to push it down.
I love this one. We've got some really compelling charts and tables here, and the SQM ones are very recent, thanks, Anne-Marie. What it shows is total property listings across the board for every single capital are down. When we look at new listings, the only two capital cities that have an increased supply, and it's very slight, are Perth and Adelaide. And we've got some significant drops in Canberra and in Hobart. it's going to absolutely impact the market because we're talking about supply and demand. But what's fascinated me is when we look at old listings, so greater than 180 days, and this measure we've talked about for a long time because we had really active buyers snapping up the stuff that no one wanted for a long time. That's just switched. It's just changed of late. So it seemed to be at its tightest in April. We've got slightly more older listings, which means the uptake of the stuff that's been on the market for a long, long time, it's just turned a corner. Whether that's a trend that we'll see continue or not, we don't know. But so far, the only city that's got tightened old listings is Brisbane, which means Brisbane buyers are still very heated and they're still snatching up whatever they can. Everyone else has had an increase, including Hobart. So supply and demand, we expect it to tighten going into winter. And if we ask ourselves, what was it that caused so much supply late last year? Because across the board, we saw it. I would say that a lot of vendors gained confidence to take the properties to market and not be impacted by lockdowns. And I would also say, sadly, we saw a lot of partnerships eroded through the pressures of lockdowns in some of our cities. And I know from my coalface that a lot of our sales were initiated by divorces and separations, which is horrible. But we can assume that those types, those categories of reasons for selling have almost been eliminated. They've been sorted out, they've sold their properties, and so now we're seeing normalised volumes.
So that's a real story, the number of old listings rising. So in Sydney, surged by 9.6% in May, so 4,032 more old listings. And in Melbourne, there was an extra 6,378. So this build-up in the older listings will put further pressure on prices as the housing market transitions.
And it also goes to show that buyers are being fussier. You know, we know that they've been scrutinising. We've talked about a two-speed market with A-grade and B-grade properties. I think a lot of buyers who were saying, yep, give me whatever it is, it's a bargain, it's in the city, I don't care if it's one better, I think they're now saying, I can take my time. FOMO's not the same. No. I'm not getting pressure from other competing buyers. Let's actually buy something good.
And you look at the price movements, again, it's reflecting listings, isn't it? So Sydney's advertised listings are 5% higher than they were a year ago and 1% above the five-year average. Melbourne's stock listings are up on last year as well and 8% above the five-year average, whereas Adelaide's almost 40% lower than the five-year average, Brisbane 38% and Perth 34%. Stock levels remain well below average in those three capital cities.
We've got about five minutes to go, so I want to get to one of my favourite tables, which is the Westpac Melbourne Institute Consumer Sentiment one. In particular, my favourite is House Price Expectations Index. Dave, did you want to talk about this first?
Yeah, House Price Expectations Index continues to be a lag indicator. We know prices have been reducing for a long time and that one's just starting to come down. What tends to be the one ahead of the curve is Time to Buy a Dwelling Index, and that's been dropped. I'd like to go back to when it did start to drop below 100 because it's been well in advance of property value starting to retract. It's actually sitting at, well, it hit another record low actually this month. So it was, I think, the lowest it's been since the GFC, down at 77 or so, I think, from memory, somewhere around there, 77.5. So they continue to tell a story.
I'm not sure if I'm reading it correctly because I still haven't found the explanatory notes for this. But if 100 means that there's just as many people think positively than negatively, then House Price Expectation Index is showing at 121, which means there are more people that think house prices will increase rather than decrease. Often indices start at 100.
Yeah.
So all that allows you to do is make comparisons with previous years, right? But if in this case 100 actually means equilibrium, then so far as time to buy a dwelling is concerned, there's a lot less people think that it's a good time to buy a dwelling. However, there's more than 50% of people think that it is, that house prices will continue to go up.
Yeah, it's a very interesting dynamic here. We look at time to buy a dwelling versus house price expectations. And it just goes to show that humans don't like to think in a manner that says, you know, when people are greedy, be fearful, and when people are fearful, be greedy. They're not approaching it like that. People felt that it was time to buy a dwelling when they felt that house prices were going mad. And unfortunately, that is what can fuel a FOMO situation, because people are looking at house prices that seem to be spinning out of control, thinking, if I don't get on the ladder now, I might never get on it. And so, you know, fear and greed is a big driver, unfortunately.
But if you look at time to buy a dwelling index, it peaked in November 2020. So the market only started moving a month or two prior. So I see that as where they think it's affordable, and whereas house price expectations I see as more of a commentary on the value of properties today. Okay, you know, we can see rates are really low. I've got plenty of money in the bank. You know, I think it's a good time to buy. You know, it peaked ahead of the market peaking, time to buy a dwelling index. So now it's at 79. It's going, look, you know, prices are super high, rates are going up. I don't see it as a good time to buy. It's down at 79. Whereas I see house price expectations is, look, I think prices are high. And so, you know, that's where that one I think is, you know, 134, because people are saying, look, prices are quite high.
Mm. Okay. So we've got a couple of minutes left. Our final topic for discussion is the lending indicators. So this is based on how much money people are borrowing over time. So, Dave, you want to point out a few things here?
Yeah, look, just quickly, it's falling.
All right, thanks for your time, everyone.
So, you know, it's usually pretty correlated with property values. So in April, the amount of finance fell by 6.4%. Now it's been increasing at record numbers over the
last... So it's coming off a big high.
Off a big high. So owner-occupiers were the main fall of 7.3%. Investors were a bit more resilient at 4.8%. And actually, just broadly, the split of owner-occupiers to investors is very like at traditional levels, at long-term sort of equilibrium, where it's about 2 out of 3 is owner-occupiers, 1 out of 3 is investors. So it's actually, that spread is a very normal marketplace.
Very good. All right. Well, thank you, Kate, and thank you, Dave. Listeners, please don't go away. We've got Kate and Dave's gold nugget still to come. As I said before, very much an action-packed episode. Lots of talk about interest rates, but interest rates do affect all of us, whether you own a business or you're an owner-occupier of a house or you're a property investor. It is a big deal. But like we've said, if you look at it historically, it has gone up a little bit, but we are still well below a 20 or 30-year average of where the cash rate or interest rates are. So we'll be back in a tick.
If you've enjoyed our podcast, leave a review on iTunes and share the episode with your friends.
Now it's time for us to go mining for our gold nugget property tip of the day.
Kate, what's your gold nugget?
I want to chat about rental yield, because there are lots of investors out there who aren't necessarily just investing for extreme capital growth. And I always think when you're planning your portfolio and you're thinking about your holding costs, yield is a massive thing to consider, as well as outgoings. Now, if you're sitting in your own city or your own region, and you're wondering what else is out there, it is a good time to explore some of the other cities around our nation, regional and capital, and have a look at their yield, because we've got increasing yields, but a lot of these yields that are on offer will enable you to hit the ground running with a positive cash flow acquisition if that's your driver. I'm not saying it's everyone's bag, but they're out there and they're growing in number.
Thank you for that, Kate. Dave?
It's a great one, Kate. You know, we're in certainly for a period of time of a flatter property market, but there are still markets moving forward. Rates are still at the lowest they've ever been. You know, we've got record savings level, unemployment lowest in 50 years, immigration's just about to come back on, rising rents and yields rising even faster. You know, greatest demand for our natural resources that we've almost ever seen. So there are, you know, we've just got to remember there's quite a few positive tailwinds as well happening at the same time.
Very true, very true. All right, thank you very much, Kate and Dave. Listeners, I hope you've enjoyed this episode, and we look forward to your company again next week. Bye for now.
Hi there, it's Anne-Marie from Property Planning Australia here. If you've enjoyed this episode and would like to learn more about some of the topics discussed, take a listen to episodes number 8, Interpreting Data to Uncover an Outstanding Property and Location, and How to Sort the Gold from the Lies, Damned Lies and Statistics. Episode 9, Why Mortgage Strategy is More Important Than Your Interest Rate. Episode 12, Property Cycle Management. Why now is always the best time to buy if it suits your personal economy and you have a long-term property plan. Episode 46, Market Update, Recovery Lessons from Recent Recessions, the Great Depression, GFC and Spanish Flu. And episode 97, Listener Questions, What Will Drive Capital Growth After Interest Rates Rise?
Thank you for joining the property planner, David Johnston, whose company Property Planning Australia provides the only independent pure planning advisory in Australia that does not buy or sell property, insurance, investment or super product.
And the property buyer, Kate Bacross, recently awarded Buyer's Agent of the Year and an owner of an independent buyer's agency in Melbourne's Inner West. And of course, the property professor, Peter Kalizos, Australia's leading property university lecturer, Chairman of Property Investment Professionals of Australia and seasoned investor and developer.
We've really enjoyed delivering this podcast and we'd love you to join us on our podcast webpage at propertyplannerbuyerandprofessor.com.au or our Facebook page. Feel free to send us any questions and Dave, Pete and I will answer them for you.
So until next time, remember that each property decision you make is leading you towards your ideal lifestyle.
Everything we talk about in this episode is general in nature and should not be considered to be financial advice. We've put a lot of effort into making sure the information is accurate, but please don't rely on this information to make a decision. If you're looking for specific advice, please seek the help of a specialist and remember, it's important you determine your trusted advisors are independent.